This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. An extended conversation with Dean Baker, senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose expertise extends to housing and consumer prices, Social Security, Medicare, trade, and employment. Dean has authored a number of books, including Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. Others of his books include Getting Back to Full Employment, A Better Bargain for Working People, The End of Loser Liberalism. Dean Baker, it's good to have you with us in these stressful, difficult times.
Hey, Mimi, thanks for having me on. I hope everyone there is getting along okay.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, the government's response to the crisis has been grossly negligent. So the question for us is how we can, as working people, as oppressed people, finally, the Senate allowed to go through the package that was first proposed in the House. And I want to look at what's in there and then what's not in that. And then we'll tackle the issue of the new construct of the $1 trillion potential stimulus. But how do you look at the package that did finally clear the Senate?
The Republicans in the Senate were determined to water down the House bill, which I have to say was not all that ambitious to begin with. The House bill, one of the big things, and a good thing, was that it required employers gave sick leave to workers at least 7 days and also extended family leave. I think it was as much as 20 days. It might have been longer, but government would, in effect, reimburse companies for this. It was a tax credit. We have a lot of workers who don't currently have sick leave on the job, roughly, I think it's 24%. It's much, much higher for lower-paid workers, 40 or 50% if you get to, say, the bottom quartile of. This would give those people paid sick days, but it had a big clause in that it didn't apply to employers of more than 500. It means people working for Walmart or other big companies, many of those people aren't going to have paid sick days, and this doesn't do anything about that. It did provide for free testing. That was a good thing, but a lot of people, of course, don't have health insurance, or even if they do have it, they have huge deductibles, so a lot of people are going to be very reluctant to get tested if they know that means that if they get tested and turns out they actually have the coronavirus, they're looking at thousands of dollars of treatment that they can't afford. In terms of boosting the economy, it does nothing. So government's going to have to take really big steps to boost the economy since very large parts of it are being shut down right now, but this particular bill doesn't do anything on that front.
The level of poverty is excruciating. Too many workers are maybe $400 away from destitution. For example, of course, there are untold numbers of people in New York City that are working off the books. Massive layoffs already and businesses that close. Devastation. Many of the people are not subject to unemployment benefits. Again, many people work off the books, etc. Is there any consideration for the masses of people who are working under those kind of conditions?
Well, in the original bill, there's really nothing apart from, you know, basically the free testing. You know, you find out you have the disease, but you can't afford the treatment. There almost certainly will be a bigger bill. We're hearing numbers tossed around, $900 billion, a trillion. That could help some of these people. I mean, there's issues what that's going to look like. The Trump administration is saying that maybe they'll send checks of $1,000 per person or $2,000 per person. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it would be better to try and keep people whole as much as possible, keeping people on their payroll. So Denmark did something like this. Just keep people on your payroll, even if you're shut down. We'll pick up 75% of the tab. You pick up 25%. They're making low-interest loans available. Now you ask, what about, you know, people who are self-employed? It's available for the self-employed. So there are things we could do like that. Will we do those? I don't know. When you talk about people in poverty or the edge of poverty who might be working off the books, a lot of those people, if we look to send them $1,000, send people $1,000 checks, $2,000 checks, there may be no record of them. I mean, in principle, they should get them. Will they get it? I don't know. And when you talk about, say, undocumented workers, they almost certainly won't get it. I much prefer going the route of trying to keep people on payrolls. The government will pick up the tab. both because I think that will do better at keeping people whole. Even say we give people $2,000, say someone earns $800, $1,000 a week, well, that gets them through a couple weeks. It won't support them if this lockdown goes 12 weeks or longer, which is entirely possible. To try to keep as many people whole as we can, will many people, the marginalized people that you're referring to, will they not be helped? I'm sure many won't, and we have to do the best we can to make sure that we could try and provide some assistance so that they don't suffer.
Many of the immigrants are now subject to the public charge rule. If they lose their source of income, etc., which of course could mean that they can't pay their rent and can wind up homeless, there's this whole chain reaction. They are being forced into a situation where their legal immigration status becomes in question and subject to jeopardy should they need to apply, which they were able to before, for public assistance. And they're not able to do that with the public charge rule. And is there any indication that there is anything within any of the new bill that is being considered something that would lift or rescind the public charge rule? Or for that matter, one can look at the work requirements that are in place for people who are on TANF and or receive SNAP benefits, food stamps.
The work requirements were taken out in the, or at least modified, again, they were removed in the House bill. So at least temporarily, whether that survived the Senate bill, again, I wish I could tell you that. I haven't seen the final one. I think it did. The public charge rules, I don't think that got into the House bill. There were a lot of people in Congress, of course, pushing to take that out, but I don't think that got into the bill. So that's, you know, raises another issue, given the fear, of course, that many people who aren't documented or have legitimate fear, of course, of being deported. It raises the issue, will these people even go in for testing? You know, will they have to worry about that, in other words? Again, we are incredibly poorly prepared for something like this, and that's, of course, horrible for them. But again, we want people tested for people to know if they have the virus, they could take measures to try and prevent the spread to others. Nancy Pelosi, she's really fallen down on this in the sense that she really can put things on there and go take it or leave it. Now, you don't want to be in a situation where we're sitting here just twiddling our fingers and, you know, we can't come to an agreement. But I have to think at the end of the day, I mean, I'll say horrible things about the Republicans and Donald Trump, but they care about the politics. And they do not want to be sitting there and not have a bill. So if they have something come through, says, okay, it has to get rid of the public charge. It has to, you know, other provisions to try and help people who you know, people in poverty, people at the edge of poverty. It's a little hard for me to believe at the end of the day that Mitch McConnell in the Senate and Donald Trump will just go, no, we can't do that. I think they would have to cave. So I wish that Nancy Pelosi would step up more.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about as I project, the issue of a 1% or 1/4 of 1%, I forget exactly what it is, that was proposed of a Robin Hood tax previously. The idea, again, of even the generic considerations that have been raised by Bernie Sanders and to some extent Elizabeth Warren of taxing the rich. It's almost staggering to me now that this would not be given real consideration and become a major talking point, certainly, or the Biden camp. I don't see what else is going to bridge the gap other than continuing to accentuate the wealth divide in this country and, again, absolute devastation of the working class in this country post this pandemic running its course.
You know, you mentioned the Robin Hood tax, just a small tax on stock trades, which could raise over $100 billion a year, more than half of 1% of GDP. It's a very large chunk of money. And it comes almost entirely at the expense of Wall Street. And, you know, to my view, what's the problem? Yeah, we absolutely have to tax higher income people more. I mean, the positive on this is Joe Biden has been moving in that direction. I mean, he wasn't my choice for the nomination, but better or worse, that looks like the guy we're getting. So, and it looks like he has moved a lot on these and other issues. One of the things that is kind of driving me nuts, we're hearing about efforts to develop a vaccine, which of course is great. There are teams in Germany, teams in China, the U.S., I'm sure elsewhere. That's great. But instead of competing, why aren't they cooperating? Why aren't they posting all their results on the web so each other could benefit from it as soon as possible so they don't make the same mistakes, they learn from the successes? And that should get us a vaccine much more quickly. And then when it's developed, it's in the public domain. We shouldn't have to beg, you know, some company that we gave a patent monopoly to. This is one of these things that's just absurd. We go, don't give them a monopoly. So it's not that we need the government to make the drugs cheap. We need the government to not make them expensive by giving them a patent monopoly. If they didn't have a patent monopoly, anyone could produce it, and it would be just like paper cups or shovels or all the things that you might get at the hardware store. How about we all work together? And why we wouldn't want open research, it's just hard for me to understand. And, you know, you'd sort of hope in this sort of crisis situation we might get a little bit of rethinking on that.
The issue of bailouts, the enormity, once again, we're looking to the airlines industry. Your thoughts on this corporate welfare, once again, avoiding what I think are just catastrophic, these bailouts of these highly concentrated industries that could have taken out insurance policies and other things. Your thoughts, Dean Baker?
Our concern here is keeping the workers whole. If it ends up being the case that these airlines, as you're saying, they could have taken out insurance, it would have been expensive. That's right. That's, well, we have an interest in making sure that the workers, the flight attendants, the machinists, all the people at the airlines, they're kept whole. It wasn't their fault. They didn't make the call. They didn't cause the virus. We have interest in keeping them whole. As far as the shareholders, well, you know, they're supposed to understand. I understand that all the shareholders are rich. I have a 401k, you know. I'm sure some of that's in the airline stock, their index funds. So, you know, I don't know what they're in, but I'm sure some of it's in the airline stocks. But that's the deal. And if it turns out we have to bail out the big airlines, well, the condition should be that we have to protect the workers, protect their pensions, their health care benefits, but the shareholders have to be out of luck. And it's funny because there's been around, well, naturally people have been talking about the last set of bailouts, and they're repeating what I'm just going to say. It's a straight-out lie. The story was if we didn't bail out the banks, we would have gotten a second Great Depression. And I was in a lot of discussions there, and it's going, tell me why we would have had a second Great Depression. And people start waving their arms, sometimes calling me names. I'm asking a reasonable question. No one ever gave me an answer. So, yes, I do not doubt for a second, had we not stepped in October when Citigroup and Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, they were all on their backs. They all would have gone bankrupt. I'm sure the initial downturn would have been worse. I would not argue that. But I always say, well, what would have prevented us the next month from having a big stimulus package where we're going to spend a lot of money installing solar energy and mass transit and all sorts of other things that we should have done a decade ago? Well, we should have done two or three decades ago, but whatever. We could have done that then. What would have stopped that and employed a huge number of people? What would have, and no one's ever been able to tell me anything. They go, oh, Congress wouldn't have approved it. I go, I don't know. You don't know what Congress would have approved, but that's a political question. That's not, you aren't telling me as an economist, you aren't giving me your expertise as an economist that we would have had a second Great Depression. You're making a political judgment, which may or may not be right. I don't know. None of us knows.
Now, with the broad sweep of COVID-19, this pandemic, it's clearly forced us into an unprecedented national emergency. And this emergency, however, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, I think really results from a deeper and much more long-term crisis, and that is of poverty and inequality in a society that ignores the needs of 140 million people who are poor to begin with, as this should provide us with an opportunity of looking to really the holes in our economy to begin with that certainly create the bedrock for what is going to be an exacerbated contradiction, distribution of wealth, terrifying impoverishment and destitution for untold numbers of people.
Getting to universal health care, that really has to be a top priority. And, you know, it was great that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were pushing for Medicare for All. Clearly, we're not going to get there all at once. I mean, they're not going to be the nominees, and, you know, Biden's not committed to it, but we have to pressure and we have to move quickly to get to universal health care. And it's very clear in this crisis. I mean, every other wealthy country go to France, go to Germany. That's at least one thing people don't have to worry about. If they get sick, they will get health care. Other things, higher minimum wages. I mean, we have to, $15 an hour is none too high. I mean, one of the things that if the minimum wage had kept pace with productivity growth, which it used to do, I mean, in other words, minimum wage used to rise in step with overall living standards prior to the late 60s. If that had continued, the minimum wage today would be $24 an hour. Principle, that's a doable thing. I'll just put it that way. And that would be a very, very different world. Other things, you know, again, we've had good discussions of child care. What Biden is prepared to do on that, I don't know. But again, that's the sort of thing we should be prepared to provide that for everyone, because it's an enormous burden. People can't afford child care. People have to work. I mean, it's one of these things we tell people they have to work, but then how are they going to be able to work, often at a low-paying job, and then still pay for child care? That's simply not possible for an awful lot of people. So there's a lot of things like that that we can do.
To what extent should this be the moment where we're developing Green New Deal-style plans for public works and infrastructure maintenance right now?
Where we are now, we should definitely be moving very quickly to try to increase our use of clean energy, conservation, mass transit, public transit, so people don't have to drive cars. This really should be front and center. And, you know, one of the nice things about it is a lot of the work required for a Green New Deal, say putting in insulation, installing solar panels on roofs, this is something that doesn't require a huge amount of training. So these could be good-paying jobs for workers that, say, don't have college degrees, and they could be trained for fairly quick. Realistically, talking about a lot of people who are currently either unemployed or employed at very low-paying jobs, having the opportunity to do.
Would you advocate that there be a significant increase in the unemployment benefits that will be given out? Since, again, I'm anticipating that people are going to be in catastrophic work situations, and certainly restaurant and hospitality industry is going to likely be shattered for an indefinite period of time, and all those workers are going to be unemployed.
Absolutely. I mean, again, we want to keep people whole, and the idea of unemployment benefits is, you know, there's sort of,
and I should say also extended to additional groups of workers, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that as well. You know, there's a lot of people, if you look at the data, you know, fewer than a third are counted as unemployed get unemployment benefits. So we have to make sure people get benefits. A lot of people don't get them because they haven't worked long enough, they didn't make enough money. There's a variety of reasons that they don't get the benefit. Also, as it was saying, punitive aspect, you have to be looking for work. You know, different states have different requirements. The jobs aren't there, so it's just silly. So what we have to do is increase the benefits, make sure more people qualify, and, you know, get rid of these sort of punitive aspects. Clearly does not make sense when so many things are shut down to be telling people to go around looking for employment, because it ain't there. It's just stupid.
And I'm still reeling and perturbed over the five largest airlines, which are pushing for a $50 billion plus bailout to help them survive COVID-19 crisis, have handed out more than $45 billion to shareholders and executives over the last 5 years. I cringe.
Yeah, we have no reason to help the shareholders there. They were not, I mean, this is, you know, it's just kind of classic that, you know, when times are good, they're happy to say, oh, yeah, we all just love the market. Now they're bad times, and they go running to the government and go, oh, you guys have to help us out. And go, well, we have an interest in keeping the workers whole. As far as the shareholders, you were profiting when times were good. Well, this is the flip side.
What should be the agenda? What is it we, the public, need to push, certainly aside from Biden, on this 116th Congress to get us through and not leave us in a state of not recession, but utter depression as we wind our way through or plow through or soldier our way through this terrible pandemic?
Well, I had mentioned earlier the policy that Denmark put in place. I think that's a very good model, because basically the idea was to try to keep workers at their jobs. I mean, I understand they aren't actually going to work, but, you know, getting their paychecks so that they could pay their bills, pay the rent, buy their food, this and that. So that I think is a very, very good model. Again, we're going to have people that will fall through the cracks. So we have to try to figure out how to deal with, you know, informal workers, people who are off the books, this and that. And we won't do that perfectly, but that has to be a priority. Also, I guess I should have said this first. I mean, the first thing really has to be deal with the health issues. And here, you know, this is where the Trump administration has just been mind-bogglingly incompetent. I mean, it just, you know, we still don't have tests. You know, they knew about this virus in China back in December, and they obviously did absolutely zero by way of precaution. We need the test. We need to have more masks, more protective gear, particularly first and foremost for the healthcare workers who are getting infected because they're testing people, they're seeing people, treating people. We need to have that. We need respirators. We don't have that. We need hospitals, you know, or makeshift hospitals that, you know, in China, they constructed hospitals in a matter of weeks. We probably don't have the means to do that, but we could do like tent hospitals or things we could do. So first and foremost, obviously, we have to deal with the medical crisis, which is a very serious one. And testing people has to be at the forefront and getting the necessary equipment. Also, one of the things I and others have talked about, training people to do sort of the more mundane tasks that that healthcare workers have to do. So we don't want nurses and, you know, other highly trained people to have to be changing bed sheets, cleaning surfaces. There are other things that they do that we could train people for in 2 or 3 weeks and relieve the stress that a lot of the healthcare workers have to be facing as they're just overwhelmed with patients. So that really should be the first priority, is caring for the sick, trying to contain the virus. And again, it's just, you know, this administration, you know, I'm sure you heard where Trump was talking about this cruise ship that was off the West Coast, and he was saying he wanted to keep the people on the ship because he didn't want his numbers to double, meaning the numbers of people who had right. the virus. He didn't have to worry about doubling because we had way more than he seemed to know about who already had been diagnosed. But in any case, he was worried about his numbers, not how to care for people, how to deal with the virus. And it's both incredible that that was his concern, but perhaps even more credible that he just said that publicly. It's on camera. It's not, you know, this isn't like a secret story. He said it to the press. So, yes, they have been, you know, almost inconceivably incompetent. If 5 months ago I had told you this is what the Trump administration was going to do, you'd just laugh at me thinking I was making fun of him.
So as we begin to wrap up, you're giving us some ideas for a Families First Coronavirus Response Act. Is there anything else that you want to make sure that's in it that we, the people, begin to advocate strongly for?
Well, I was mentioning before about the public research for the coronavirus. This is such a dramatic story that I would really hope we could do this year, and it's important for the coronavirus, but it's important for prescription drugs more generally. I mean, people often don't realize how much is at stake here. So we're going to spend over $500 billion on prescription drugs this year. That's about 2.5% of GDP. And if we snapped our fingers and we removed the patent protections or other protections like that, and we just said anyone could, you know, subject to safety standards, of course, but anyone, drugs are all generics, in other words, we'd probably save $400 billion a year. And just to give you some perspective, that's more than 5 times the annual food stamp budget. We have a lot of big fights in Washington over efforts to cut the food stamp budget. And those are important. I don't mean to trivialize that at all. But this is 5 times the whole budget. So if we can get, if we could set this example that, yes, we're going to have public research, and then whatever they come up with, that's cheap. It's going to be sold as a generic. It'll be cheap for everyone. If we could get one model like that so that we could say, yeah, we want to do this more generally, that would be make a really, really big difference in healthcare costs and people's access to drugs. And I should also point out, when we give them patents, it's an invitation for corruption. The reason that Purdue Pharma and the other manufacturers of opioids were so anxious to push it was because we gave them patent monopolies. If these were selling as cheap generics, they're not going to have a big reason to go out and tell doctors, oh, don't worry, it's not addictive. I mean, people always lie and push, you know, they do that for trivial things, but they would not have made such a big effort if they didn't have a patent monopoly. So if we could get people to rethink how we finance research, and, you know, again, this is just kind of such a glaring time. We're putting up most of the money. So it's not as though Pfizer or the other big drug companies could say, oh, we're taking a big risk. You aren't taking a risk. We're giving you the money. So that would be a huge thing.
And lastly, I just want to go back to one thing that we just glanced over, and that was the issue of whether they put a $1,000 check to each family, or as Bush did post 9/11, $2,000, etc. There's your colleagues have raised a question about whether or not giving away money to everyone was really a good response to a recession caused by a pandemic. Can you address that?
Yeah, I think the priority, when we're talking about a large amount of money, what's going to be our main effort to counter this, you know, recession, depression, whatever we want to call it? I think it has to be along the Danish model, keeping people employed. One of the arguments, you know, for back, you know, when Bush sent out the checks was that, oh, we want people to spend it. And that made sense in that context. That won't make sense in the context today. I understand for some people, they're going to need this money to pay their rent. But in a lot of cases, we're going to send people $1,000 checks. It's not that people aren't spending it not because they don't have the money. They're not spending because they don't want to go to a restaurant. They don't want to go see a movie. That's the reason people aren't spending money. So it's kind of wrongheaded. What we have to do is try and keep people whole by keeping their paychecks coming. So that, to my view, has to be the first priority.
Well, Dean Baker, is there a final thought, or not final, because I sincerely hope that we can continue to have you agitate and organize us to develop an economy and the demands for an economy that are in the needs and of the people that put families first in this terrible time of pandemic, and preparing us for what we need to do as we emerge from it, which we surely will.
Well, you know, the point I would say is that we can keep people from suffering too much, and that has to be a priority. It's not, you know, it's not your average worker, the person, you know, working in a restaurant or cleaning bathrooms. This isn't their fault, and those people should not be the ones suffering from a lot of mistakes. And just to, you know, not that I don't mind beating up on Trump, but this isn't just gratuitous beating up. This was 100% preventable. A competent president would have seen this coming and taken the necessary steps before it became a mass pandemic. And he just didn't do it because he didn't care, didn't think about it, whatever you want to say. So it's just an unbelievable tragedy that so many people are going to needlessly suffer.
Dean Baker, senior economist, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. I really want to thank you for taking the time to be with us, for helping be our North Star in the economic field during this terribly, terribly trying period, and encourage people to go to the website and continue to inform themselves so that we can develop the demands. And we will figure out additional ways to organize. As we are limited in social distancing now, we're going to have to figure out better ways to use social media to make our demands heard. Thank you so much for being with us, and of course, stay safe and continue to deliver the cogent information that you do to the public.
Well, thanks very much for having me on, and you also and your listeners do your best to stay safe.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.